For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. Back in June, during the Euro 2020 tournament, Danish footballer Christian Eriksen collapsed on field after suffering a sudden cardiac arrest. Thankfully, medical staff revived him after one round of defibrillation using an automated external defibrillator. Eriksen was later fitted with an implantable cardioverter defibrillator and has recovered well, although it seems unlikely that he will play at the elite level again.
We also know that competitive exercise, especially at the highest levels, can be a trigger for something that might already be underlying, and that's the rationale for screening at those elite intense levels of exercise.
That's Dr. Jessica Orchard, who is a Heart Foundation postdoctoral fellow and an adjunct senior lecturer at the Centenary Institute and the University of Sydney. I invited her along today to talk with us about sudden cardiac death in athletes, how we can prepare for it, screen for it, and hopefully prevent it. Welcome to the pod, Jessica. How common is sudden cardiac death in this country?
In Australia, around 2,000 people under 50 die of sudden cardiac death per year. So that's in the under 50s. At all ages, it's around 20 to 25,000. And in people under 35, it's 1.3 per 100,000 people per year. It is quite rare under 35. And it's important to remember that while it is rare and we shouldn't be too afraid of it in terms of going out and enjoying some exercise, it's still really important to prepare, because if it does happen, you really want to be able to respond as quickly and as effectively as possible with CPR and defibrillation.
Do we know what causes it?
In people under 35, there's no single major cause, although the majority of known causes in younger people do tend to have a genetic component. And so when you're looking at the genetic component, so that's something that might be inherited through families, you can then broadly divide those conditions into cardiomyopathies and rhythm disturbances. And so the most common of the cardiomyopathies is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM, which affects about 1 in 500 people.
Is it more common in athletes? Is it something to do with being like high levels of exercise or anything like that?
To some extent, we don't actually know. And it's important to point out that 40% of sudden cardiac deaths in young people remain unexplained even after autopsy. But we do know that the risks vary in different athletes and different sports and different populations. And so we know the risks are higher for male athletes versus female athletes. And some ethnicities are also at higher risk. So Black African American basketballers, and especially males, are one of the highest risk groups, with an incidence of 1 in 3,000 athletes per year in the college competition, the NCAA in the US, which is about 14 times higher than the rate overall in the NCAA cohort in one of the studies reported. So we do know that there is a lot of variable risk in different groups. We also know that competitive exercise, especially at the highest levels, can be a trigger for something that might already be underlying. And that's the rationale for screening at those elite intense levels of exercise.
So to what extent is screening now a standard thing in amongst the professional sporting organisations?
So it's true that many sports in Australia and internationally have a cardiac screening program for elite athletes. And to an extent, these programs are very well run, and they generally include a 12-lead ECG. And while ECGs aren't perfect, they do have the best combination of sensitivity and specificity in terms of picking up conditions that can be associated with sudden cardiac death. So there's also usually a history and physical examination that goes with it, which is an important part, but accompanied by an ECG, it brings up the sensitivity and specificity of the test to a much higher level. So those programs, while they are very good, they definitely can't pick up everything. And it's important that we also understand the limitations. But in elite sport, there's a really good work health and safety rationale for doing it, because we're asking athletes to push their bodies to the absolute maximum level they possibly can in the course of their employment. So if there is something underlying there that would affect their health in being able to do that, it's important to have a look for that too.
Does that 12-lead ECG include a stress test? Is it under duress?
No, it's usually a resting 12-lead, except in very small number of sports like cycling. I think they do a stress test and an echocardiogram in alternating years. That's a very high cardiac demand sport, which has had quite a lot of incidents in the past. But the general thing is to do it as a resting 12-lead ECG and follow up with a stress ECG if required for any reason.
Obviously, in Christian Eriksen's case, the presence of a defibrillator was the difference between him living and dying. Do all Australian sports stadium now have AEDs available, and is that mandated?
You're absolutely right that a defib can easily be the difference between life and death. And it's really important to emphasise that time to defibrillation is absolutely critical. So the ideal time is 2 to 5 minutes, and survival drops by 10% for every minute of delay. So time's absolutely critical. I would think that the vast majority of large arenas in Australia would have a defibrillator, at least one, and hopefully more than one in different areas. I don't think it's mandated by legislation in Australia, and that's something we could look at improving, because really that's one of the most useful and proven techniques to reduce the incidence of death from sudden cardiac arrest.
And given we're talking about elite athletes, presumably should we be doing that all the way down to club level, to junior level?
Absolutely. There's a lot of people who are engaging in sport, and overwhelmingly physical activity is of benefit, and overwhelmingly sudden cardiac arrest is rare. That said, it's still really important that we prepare for it, because if it happens, we want to do everything we can to prevent the young person or any person, in fact, from dying. So absolutely at club level. And there are various programs around Australia rolling it out, although it's a little bit patchwork across the different states. And there's a lot more we could do in terms of mandating defibs in all situations. The other thing that needs to go with defibs, especially at club level, but at all levels, is cardiac emergency planning. So you have to have an emergency plan that's written down. You need to know where that defib is. It needs to be in working order. That means the battery's there and all that sort of thing. And you need people who are also trained in CPR, and importantly, symptom recognition, because until you recognise that it's a cardiac arrest, or possibly, you're not able to take those next steps like calling 000, commencing CPR and getting the defib. So there's a lot of logistics that go with it, and it can be as simple as making sure it's not hidden in a locked cupboard where nobody knows where it is. It possibly needs to be on the wall with a large signpost.
I'm chatting today with Dr. Jessica Orchard, a Heart Foundation postdoctoral fellow and adjunct senior lecturer at the Centenary Institute and the University of Sydney. If you are involved in a sporting club in New South Wales which doesn't yet have an AED, the New South Wales Government Office of Sport runs a local sport defibrillator grant program. You can email them at grantsunit, all one word, at sport.nsw.gov.au. Other states run similar programs, which you can find on their state government websites. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can catch up with all our episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are free to access. You can subscribe to our feed at Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Back to our chat. The MJA's weekly news magazine, Insight Plus, did a story this week about some MJA research on the success or otherwise of defibrillation in GP clinics. People who are twice as likely to survive if defib was started in the GP clinic rather than waiting for the paramedic to arrive. Should all accredited GP clinics have an AED, do you believe?
Absolutely. I read that study with interest, and it's absolutely right, and surprising, in fact, that that's not already a requirement, because people might be seeking medical care because they've got some symptoms in the lead up, and certainly in older people when they're having a heart attack, which might have some warning symptoms in the sort of days and hours prior, it's quite likely that they might present at their GP and have an arrest there. So it's absolutely should be a recommendation that defibrillators are there. I mean, ideally we would have them sort of almost everywhere, but you've also got to pick the places that are potentially the low-hanging fruit. So GP clinics, obviously hospitals, sports stadiums, community sport. And recently I read that Coles and Woolworths are going to have defibrillators in all their stores nationally, being quite a lot of arrests in supermarkets. And so obviously that's a really good area to put them. And especially all those areas where there's always some staff, you can always have someone trained, always have someone knowing where it is and maintaining it. The challenges of putting them there are much lower and the yields much higher. So I think that's really, really important.
I know it's called sudden cardiac arrest, so this is probably a stupid question, but would an athlete like Christian have had any warning at all that something was not right?
It's really hard to know in his specific case, and it has been reported that he was regularly screened while he was at Tottenham, and you'd hope that if anything was amiss, that would have come out there. So in his case, we're not sure. In general terms, some people do have some warning signs, and that could be anything from perhaps collapse or fainting on exercise. That'd be one where you should absolutely go and seek medical attention. That's a really concerning symptom. It's also possible that you might have had something where you just didn't quite feel right in the lead up. There is some data, I think, from France showing that a lot of sudden cardiac arrests involve a little bit of warning of some type, especially in hindsight. And I guess what we need to do is learn what those are so we can anticipate sudden cardiac arrests, as well as working on prevention and defibrillation after the event. But I think it's really important to say that in a lot of cases, there might not have been any warning whatsoever.
You mentioned earlier that there's a genetic component, possibly. Can you see the day when we're screening athletes for their genomic details? Is that a possibility in the future? I know it's getting cheaper and cheaper to do that.
I think at this point, that's certainly not supported by the data in a broad fashion. I guess this is the time where you need to really emphasise the importance of research. And so we've got projects like the End Unexplained Cardiac Death Registry in Australia, which is Australia's first multi-source surveillance registry of sudden cardiac arrest and death that's targeting young patients under 50. And it includes a bio repository as well as state-of-the-art resources for clinicians and a leading research platform and resources for patients. But projects like this are hopefully the things that can build up these answers for us. And that's been started in Victoria and will be progressively rolled out nationally. It's led by Associate Professor Andre LaGersh, who's one of the absolute world experts in this area. It's really what we need. We need the data. We need to know. And I think genetics are an important part of the picture.
So what are the prospects for somebody like Christian, who now has an internal defibrillator installed? Is he going to be able, or are athletes who have survived this, do they ever get back to playing elite sport, or are they pretty much sidelined?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it's really important that Ericsson has been publicly open about having had an ICD put in, because the more people who are clear about that, the more it's normalised for somebody else who might have to make that decision later. I think once you've had a sudden cardiac arrest and have an ICD, you've certainly shown that you have a risk and a propensity. And so it's probably a very carefully balanced question and decision by his treating clinicians. One of the clinicians in England, who's very senior, has come out and said he would be quite risky to return to sport at this level based on that. And certainly there are examples of other athletes who have retired, like James Medway, who's a rower who collapsed in Italy. Certainly some with ICDs have retired. And then I guess you go into some of the subtle detail. And so some people may have an ICD implanted because they've had a diagnosis, but they haven't yet had an arrest. And there are examples of athletes playing high-level sport with an ICD and going fine. But it might depend on what condition they have, with some being higher risk than others. So James Medway has ARVC, and that's one of the really nasty ones. And also being a rower, he's in a more isolated environment out on the water. So if something does happen, it's much harder to respond quickly and appropriately.
If I'm a GP with patients who are junior athletes or elite athletes, is there a conversation I should be having with these patients before something happens?
Well, I guess the most important thing to note here is that it's important for anyone to seek medical advice if they've had a family member who's had a cardiac arrest under the age of about 40, because that may be due to a genetic cause and it may be worth investigating that further. Anyone who has worrying symptoms should seek medical advice, especially fainting or collapse during exercise. or really anything that's really worrying them, so the patient can be a bit of a gauge of that. But overall, we really need to emphasise the benefits of exercise far outweigh the risks, and that on balance, cardiac events for young people are relatively rare. So for athletes at the elite level, screening is likely to be organised by their sport. So at the GP level, I think it's much more focused on the concerning family history or concerning symptoms.
What's the future look like in terms of the current research? Where are things heading in this field?
So that's a really good point. And as I mentioned before, the NUCD registry project is one of the leading research projects we have in Australia that will hopefully be able to provide some answers for families and also for research going forward. And I think what we need to do is adopt this as a national research priority. And the first way to do that is to understand that the prevalence is a bit higher than we'd actually thought. By having a registry and actually having those numbers, we're able to begin that process of understanding that it's a big problem. But I guess we can clearly see how something like cancer or road trauma deaths can be prevented. And there's been a lot of work done and a lot of improvements made in those areas. But we need to also have a similar mentality when it comes to things like unexplained cardiac death. And so while rates of cardiovascular deaths have declined a lot in the patient population aged over 50, we actually haven't done a lot under 50, and those rates remain largely unchanged. So by having more research and more ability to provide families with psychological support and comprehensive family screening if required, we're hopefully able to really get some more strategies for prevention in place.
Thanks, Jessica.
No worries.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.